Support for this podcast comes from Wise, one account for over 50 currencies. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all from your Wise account. You always get the real exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees, helping you save on currency conversion wherever your money takes you. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com/world.
The U.S. assassinates the head of Al-Qaeda, a big win for Washington. Still, some are asking, why did it take so long?
It means that something was fundamentally wrong about the strategies, policies, and operations of the war on terror.
Also, we look at what comes next for the terrorist group without its leader.
Al-Qaeda is looking for an infusion of new blood, of younger leaders, of someone that can inspire the next generation of jihadist recruits.
Also today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi lands in Taiwan. Oil companies take in record profits from those high gas prices. And winemaking in a Massachusetts auto body shop, Portuguese style.
Doesn't give you that aftertaste. With the good food next to you, a gallon of wine doesn't last long.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is dead. President Biden made the announcement last night. He said Zawahiri was killed at a safe house in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The news comes almost 1 year after Biden declared the end of the war in Afghanistan. Biden said American troops have left, but the U.S. won't hesitate to go after anyone who poses a threat to its national security. The Royal Shirin Jafari begins our coverage.
For someone at the top of the world's most wanted terrorist list, Ayman al-Zawahiri managed to escape death for a long time.
I think he has very, very good personal and operational security.
Aaron Zelen is a fellow with the Middle East Institute for Near East Policy. He says Zawahiri had been involved in jihadi movements going back to the 1960s. He was born in Egypt and was a physician by training. He later became a deputy to Osama bin Laden.
They worked together on, you know, all of the plans that Al-Qaeda tried to do pre and post 9/11.
After the U.S. killed Osama bin Laden in 2011, Zawahiri became the top Al-Qaeda leader. He spent more than two decades on the run. Last night, President Biden said he authorized the strike that killed Zawahiri a week ago.
Justice has been delivered, and this terrorist leader is no more.
The U.S. was reportedly able to target Zawahiri when he appeared on the balcony of the house he was staying in. Aaron Zelen says that surprised him, given how careful the Al-Qaeda leader had been in the past.
It's clear, though, that he finally made a mistake by feeling a little too comfortable now that the Taliban is back in control of Afghanistan.
The operation to kill Zawahiri required a lot of prep work, says Seth Jones of the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
A combination of human intelligence on the ground, so spies, that has to be married up with other types of all-source intelligence collected from signals, phones, computers.
Jones, who worked on counterterrorism operations, says drones played a key role.
They can loiter for long periods of time over the target and collect information, including video imagery of the target.
But Douglas Senden, who retired from the CIA in 2019, having served 34 years, says drones are only helpful when they have a starting point.
They can't just know where to go without being guided there. Generally, start points are provided by human sources.
That means people on the ground with reliable information. London, who is now with the Middle East Institute, says by moving to Kabul, Zawahiri made his location known to a lot more people.
The Western intel community's services are strongest in Kabul. There's still Westerners in Kabul. There's still not necessarily U.S. intel boots on the ground, but it's also a busy city with lots of communications.
Former Afghan official and writer Tabesh Farooq says he wasn't surprised at all that the head of Al-Qaeda was living in the heart of Kabul, not far from the former U.S. embassy.
We have always been telling the world that these terror networks have been interconnected, intertwined.
As part of the deal that set the stage for the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban agreed not to allow groups like Al-Qaeda to operate freely. But Farooq says he never trusted the Taliban to keep that promise, and he was surprised that the U.S. did.
If after 20 years of the U.S. engagement in Afghanistan, you still have the lead of Al-Qaeda back in Kabul, hosted by the Taliban. It means that something was fundamentally wrong about strategies, policies, and operations of the war on terror.
Farooq says it also means that the U.S. might have withdrawn its troops from Afghanistan, but that the war continues from the skies. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
So what's next for Al-Qaeda? Here to help us sort that out is Colin Clark. He's the research director of the Sufan Group. Colin, in the aftermath of the drone strike that killed Ayman al-Zawahiri, there's a lot of talk now about the likely successor. Who's waiting in the wings?
I think to start, we'd have to look at Saif al-Adel. He's a veteran jihadist. Like Zawahiri, he's an Egyptian with a career and experience in the Egyptian special forces. He's someone that's long been thought of as being kind of next in the line, although there are some drawbacks there since he's based in Iran, which makes him a bit more vulnerable, especially considering what happened to another longtime al-Qaeda leader, Abu Muhammad al-Masri, who's believed to be killed by Israeli commandos in Iran a couple of years ago. You've also got Abdel Rahman al-Maghrebi. Now, he's interesting because he's also a veteran jihadist and he's Zawahiri's son-in-law.
I want to go back to Saif al-Adel. You say he's in Iran. How does that work? What has he been doing in Iran?
A lot of al-Qaeda leaders fled Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion in late 2001, and a handful ended up in Iran. It's unclear exactly what their status is. Some have described it as house arrest, others as semi-house arrest. But needless to say, they're kind of under the thumb and the watchful eye of the Iranian regime. And so how would al-Qaeda deal with having a leader that's living in a Shia country, right? One that al-Qaeda has taken plenty of shots at in its propaganda over the years. And what does that say about, you know, who might be manipulating the kind of day-to-day operations of the organization?
Wouldn't that be a reason not to name Saif al-Adel the successor if his movements and activity may be constrained by the fact that he's in Iran?
Indeed. I think it's one of the reasons why al-Adel might not be the ultimate choice. I think the other kind of mark against him is his age. Adel is believed to be in his late 60s, early 70s, but al-Qaeda is looking for an infusion of new blood, of younger leaders, of someone that can inspire the next generation of jihadist recruits. And it's unlikely that someone like Saif al-Adel, although he has the name recognition, would be able to do that and to compete with the Islamic State for that next generation of hearts and minds.
What does it mean to be the leader of al-Qaeda these days? I mean, you mentioned that al-Zawahiri was deeply unimpressive and uncharismatic. Is it a loyalty thing, or does the leader of al-Qaeda these days do lots of things and make lots of decisions and decide strategy?
Well, I say certainly decide strategy probably is less involved in the day-to-day and the tactical decisions. But, you know, you have to remember that the leader of al-Qaeda pledges bayat to the head of the Taliban, right? So that's another relationship right now that's undergoing a lot of scrutiny. The fact that Zawahiri was in Kabul when he was killed, you know, caught a lot of people by surprise because he clearly felt comfortable operating right there in the Afghan capital. And it also says to me that the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, and al-Qaeda, they remain in lockstep. They've never broken or severed ties as they were supposed to do, you know, as a result of the Doha Agreement.
You mentioned that there's a need for the next leader of al-Qaeda to be able to appeal to younger people. What are the generational differences in terms of priorities?
Well, I think you still have this kind of divide along the near enemy versus the far enemy. And Zawahiri was long a proponent of the near enemy, which meant attacking those apostate regimes in the Middle East, countries like Egypt, Syria, and others, whereas bin Laden was long a proponent of the far enemy. And so that was going after what he considered the root of all evil, which was the Crusader Zionist nexus, the United States and Israel. And it's really difficult to do what bin Laden did, right, to pull off an attack like 9/11. I think it was an anomaly in many ways. And in some ways, it was counterproductive for al-Qaeda because it set the bar so high that it was almost impossible to replicate. And so anything that al-Qaeda did that was less than 9/11 was considered a subpar. And so they were never quite able to measure up to that bar of 9/11.
Colin Clark is the research director at the Sufan Group. He's been talking with us about what's next for al-Qaeda in the aftermath of the drone strike that killed Ayman al-Zawahiri. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
After many days of intense speculation, Nancy Pelosi touched down in Taiwan today. The House Speaker is the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit there in 25 years. China's government is not happy about it. It views the self-governing island as a Chinese province gone rogue. The White House says it could not stop Pelosi's visit because the chief executive does not control Congress. The Biden administration has said it does not want to intentionally provoke Beijing. In Taiwan itself, many people are excited about Speaker Pelosi's visit. The World's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is on the line. Patrick, how is the public in Taiwan looking at this visit?
For the most part, Carol, I think that Pelosi will be warmly welcomed. The conversation about her in the U.S. and China has focused on risks and threats, but to Taiwan's government, this really is a huge breakthrough. Pelosi is expected to meet tomorrow with the elected president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, and China portrays her as a radical secessionist, but here you will have one of the more powerful U.S. politicians giving her legitimacy. I spoke with a political analyst in Taiwan, Win Tee-sung, and I asked him how everyday voters in Taiwan are going to feel about this trip.
Most of them are in a positive mood. They were a little down before because this visit has been floating around since April, so Taiwanese were a little bit in a expectation management mode.
Now, there are many warnings from Beijing about the consequences of a high-level visit to Taiwan. There was even talk about Chinese fighter jets intercepting the plane as Nancy Pelosi was on it. How has Beijing responded so far?
Well, China is conducting naval exercises on the seas near Taiwan, live fire exercises. Those were hastily announced. It has also flown fighter jets through the Taiwan Strait earlier today. And then just to turn up the temperature even more, the People's Liberation Army released a video that very explicitly shows troops conducting a mock invasion, bombing targets with jets, and generally doing maneuvers out of an action movie.
Wow, it sounds like Top Gun Maverick.
It's very Top Gun, yes.
Now, what is the view in Taiwan about the saber rattling from China?
So Win Tee-sung, the political scientist, he said that Taiwanese people are not panicking right now, not at all, that they are accustomed to belligerent rhetoric from China, and it kind of melts into the background. As far as talk that Pelosi's visit could trigger an actual invasion of Taiwan, which is something some Chinese commentators have floated, Win Tee-sung says that that is really unlikely, at least in the short term. For starters, President Xi Jinping this fall will be anointed for a historic third term as China's leader. He does not want any drama preceding that. Win Tee-sung also pointed out some strategic reasons why that just doesn't make sense right now.
A Chinese invasion, if it were ever to happen, will need the element of surprise before other potential friends like US, Japan, Australia, and others have enough time to mobilize, respond, and help.
In other words, China is not going to invade during what is the most high-profile event in Taiwan in years.
Got it. US-China relations have been difficult, to say the least, for several years. How do you think a visit to Taiwan at this moment by the House Speaker could impact them further?
As far as what retaliation could look like, Carol, it doesn't have to be a military response. It could look like less U.S.-China cooperation on shared goals such as climate change, or China refusing the White House's insistence that Beijing not arm Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Just yesterday, China banned many food exporters from Taiwan from shipping food into China just to hurt Taiwan's economy. So ultimately, yes, there will be a cost paid for Pelosi's visit by the U.S. and Taiwan, even if the cost isn't military action or some massive invasion.
The World's Patrick Nguyen speaking to us from Bangkok. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
Gas prices are high and energy companies are posting big profits. But the connection is a little more complicated than that. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Many of us have been outraged by the price of gasoline over the past few months. Well, ready to dial up your outrage a little bit more? Multinational oil companies are reporting record profits. Here to explain is Ellen Wald. She's a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council, where she monitors global energy trends. Ellen, what's driving the big profits for energy companies?
The biggest driver here is the incredible increase in oil prices. the fact that companies can sell a barrel of oil for many more times than they could before is really the driver here of increased profits. Prices were above 100 for most of the past quarter, and that's way up from, you know, when they were in the 40s or even the 60s for actually quite some time.
So is it fair to be outraged at these record profits?
I wouldn't tell anyone whether it's fair or not fair to be outraged at these record profits, but I wouldn't be surprised because most of the price of gasoline is the price of oil. And if that's what oil is going for in the market, if demand is high and there's not a whole lot of supply, and then you also have these geopolitical events like the issues between Russia and Ukraine, and you have the sanctions in response to that, the price of a barrel of oil is definitely going to go up.
Now, gas prices have been falling, but still, it's pretty expensive. Is it still fair, though, to say that oil companies are just taking advantage of the moment?
I don't think they're taking advantage of the moment. The price of oil is set by the market. If people want to really be angry, they could be angry at the traders who make a lot of money off of trading barrels of oil on, you know, the commodities exchanges. And so one of the areas that people could be very upset about is the fact that in the United States, the number of the amount of refineries has gone down. In fact, we have a capacity that's at least a million barrels a day less of refining capacity than we used to. And that is contributing to the rise in the price of gasoline that has nothing to do with oil companies and the price of a barrel of oil.
If we all decided to reduce our demand for gas, what impact would that have on prices?
Well, that would definitely help bring prices down. It would take a little while because the effect on prices isn't immediate. But if, say, there was a recession and people got laid off and they stopped driving to work and they stopped driving so much and they stopped buying so much gasoline, that would definitely reverberate throughout the entire process. And we would definitely see the price of gasoline come down.
So looking ahead, what are the chances that the price of oil is going to come down?
So if there is a global recession, then oil prices tend to drop as a result. Increased supply could also cause oil prices to go down. If, say, certain producers that have the ability to produce more, like Saudi Arabia, decided they wanted to produce more oil, or the United States started to produce more oil, don't see Saudi Arabia or other OPEC members really increasing their production much. And I don't see U.S. production really growing all that much. So I would say the best hope to reduce oil prices is either for there to be a recession or for the military conflict between Russia and Ukraine to be resolved and the sanctions to be ended, because that has put a huge geopolitical premium on the price of oil right now.
Ellen Wald is a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council, where she monitors global energy trends. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Settling in a new country means adopting new ways of living while trying to maintain many of the traditions from back home. For immigrants from the Portuguese islands of the Azores, that includes preserving a centuries-old technique for making wine. It's a tradition some families have kept alive in the U.S. for decades now. From New Bedford, Massachusetts, Daniel Ackerman from GBH Public Radio has our story.
In the rear garage of Lusso's auto body shop, shelves are lined with squeegees, a power washer, bottles of polish. But today, no one's buffing scratches off a Honda Civic.
It's gonna dump on the floor.
As half a dozen men mill around, two take turns pouring buckets of purple pulp into a waist-high wooden barrel.
They call this must?
The must is a mix of crushed grapes, including the skins and some stems. It's a 50-50 blend of Zinfandel and Alicante varieties. With the barrel just about to overflow, one of them slaps a wooden disc atop the must and turns a metal hand crank.
There we go. Let him walk.
With each spin, the disc descends into the barrel, pressing down on the must. And in a few seconds, a spout at the bottom of the barrel begins to run.
Oh, here we go.
And it's like they've struck gold.
Oh yeah, a lot of juice in it. Look at that.
John Pinheiro owns the auto shop. He grew up on Faial Island in the Portuguese Azores. Pinheiro's father was the harpooner on a whaling ship in the 1930s and 40s. but he'd return home to the family farm each fall when the grapes ripened.
Friends and family, they all get together. They go on the fields with baskets, and they pick the grapes, and they carry on their back to the adega.
An adega is the small countryside cabin where everyone gathered to press the grapes and ferment the wine, usually accompanied by food and song. Pinero went to boarding school across the island from his family's farm, but he played hooky to get back to the adega each fall.
I always try to get a day or two to go help out make the wine.
But in the late 1950s, when Pinero was 17, a volcano erupted on Fayal. Pinero's family evacuated across the Atlantic to New Bedford. The transition was hard.
When I left the island, I cried. If I could swim back when I first came here, I would have swam back.
Pinero's father started an auto body shop where Pinero eventually went to work. To his family, everything about their new life felt unfamiliar. Except, each fall, his father went to the store to buy grapes by the caseload and crush them.
From that on, we keep pretty much the same tradition.
60 years later, the taste of the wine Pinero makes in this garage still brings him back to Fayal. As we talk, he pours a bottle of last year's vintage, a Zinfandel. His longtime friend, John Branco, approves.
It goes smooth. Doesn't give you that aftertaste. With a good food next to you, a gallon of wine doesn't last long.
Speaking of good food, as the pressing goes on, more people make their way into the garage, balancing platters of Portuguese delicacies to share.
Fayal ribs, the famous beans and ribs. Oh, delicious.
More than a third of New Bedford's residents claim Portuguese ancestry. Same with nearby Fall River. The winemaking is how families like Pinheiro's connect with their histories and homeland.
Hey! How you doing, Richard?
By now, about a dozen of Pinheiro's friends and family are here to help with the winemaking, or at least offer opinions on technique.
Slowly, slowly. Don't overdo it.
Outside the garage, afternoon turns to evening. They've pressed more than 1,000 pounds of grapes. Soon, they'll barrel the juice for fermentation. The group huddles around the grape press, debating color and acidity. But today is about more than just the wine, says Joe Cordero.
This is about friendship, tradition. And the wine is just a means to get us all together and have a good time. And it helps when you have a superior product. It helps.
You can buy this anywhere on the world. Sometimes you get people to try it. You say, where can I buy this? No.
At Lusso's Auto Shop, the wine is not for sale.
So,
for the world, I'm Daniel Ackerman.
This is The World. An unexpected summertime hit song in Norway. It's in Norwegian and Arabic with a grooving beat.
It's hooks and hooks and hooks, and it's really, really good hooks. And if you listen to it like once or twice, you go on humming it for days as well.
And while the music is fun and upbeat, the song is rooted in social commentary about identity and immigration. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Like pretty much everywhere, schools in India have been hit hard by the pandemic. In remote regions of the country, they've been dealing with an added challenge, schools struggling to find teachers. But increasingly, young Indians from urban centers are now volunteering to help out. Furkan Latif Khan has our story from India's Ladakh region in the northernmost part of the country.
Ahil Ibrahim. Adina Noor.
A teacher calls roll in a classroom at Turtuk Valley School. Sara Shah runs this institution. She's a 31-year-old engineer turned educator and originally came here by chance.
I had come to Ladakh for a holiday with my cousins, and that's when a taxi driver told me about this place in Ladakh. He said there's a village called Turtuk, jo bahut dur hai, not many teachers go there, and they're in dire need of teachers because of the geographical distance. Back then there was no network, no internet, so it was completely cut off.
Shah was born and brought up in the tech city of Bengaluru in central India. About 5 years ago, she decided to take a break from her work to volunteer as a teacher. And she was looking for places that would benefit from her services.
Not many government teachers from Leh or the main district from Srinagar would come and stay here for longer durations. So there were always months the school would go without teachers. So that's when I came here, I offered my services. I was volunteering at one of the schools in Turtuk.
Nestled between the high peaks of the Himalayan region, Turtuk is one of the last villages of India before the border with Pakistan starts. The village has a handful of public schools, but locals are not very satisfied with their quality of education. They complain about lack of well-trained teachers and believe that students are not adequately prepared for the outside world. 28-year-old Hamida Bano grew up here. Personally, when I left the village for higher education, she says, I used to feel my peers were 10 times ahead of me in reading and writing. I feel like I faced a lot of issues because of not having a good basic knowledge. After leaving Turtuk, Bano got a degree in psychology and has just moved back. She says she has put three of her younger siblings in Turtuk Valley School and they are learning well. But many children in rural villages don't have this opportunity. Rough terrain and long distances have been a major roadblock for delivering quality education in the region of Ladakh. Often to get a good education, people migrate to cities. Sonam Bangchuk is a local educator.
So they bring their children to a private school in the city. And with that starts a whole cascading, damage to the village because the child leaves, then the mother leaves and rents an apartment in the city. And then when the mother leaves, the farming gets damaged when left to elderly people. So it is very, very important that we strengthen the rural schools.
And that's why Sara Shah decided to open her own school in 2020. It runs out of a bare two-story building. The corridors double up as staff room and a nursery class, and a dusty piece of land in the front serves as the playground. Turtuk Valley School is a not-for-profit supported by donors and young volunteers who Shah says want to contribute to the local education system.
The backbone of the school are the volunteers. The exposure volunteers bring in, like everybody comes from different walks of life, so they come and share their experiences, how their schooling was. So that way the kids get to know a lot more about what is out of the village.
In a sixth grade classroom, Yashraj interacts with about eight students. He's a 22-year-old data scientist.
I actually volunteered for mathematics, but I am doubling up as a science teacher as well as an English teacher for second grade. So I have second grade, fifth grade and sixth grade.
Raj is between jobs and wanted to put his free time to good use. And he has come all the way from India's capital, New Delhi, to volunteer as a teacher in Turtuk for a month.
I mean, it's difficult to get to here. So we cannot ignore this fact, and there is a scarcity of proper educators here. So if I get to be a part of something like this, I'll be happy to do that.
India is seeing a rise in young people volunteering to enter the education sector in the last decade, says Rajshri Doshi, who works for Teach for India, a non-governmental organization founded in 2009 that supports young people who want to teach in underserved schools across the country.
The generation that came 15 years back realized the value of education. Either they got that superb education or they did not get but realized the value.
India has had the second longest pandemic-led school closures in the world, and 80% of children between 14 to 18 years have had lower learning levels, according to a report by UNICEF. Sara Shah started Turtuk Valley just before the pandemic started.
So when the children came back, a lot of them had even forgotten how to read. We are still struggling with a three-letter word and four-letter word for a fourth grader now.
At such a time, volunteers have been a valuable resource. Turtuk Valley and the volunteers who staff it are demonstrating a way to reach students in parts of the country where education is lacking. For The World, I'm Furqan Latif Khan, Turtuk, India.
Hundreds of sea lovers are taking to the Western Mediterranean this summer to kayak, surf, and, it turns out, hunt for microplastics. It's part of a citizen science project. Volunteers are collecting and sharing data with investigators who are often too busy for extensive fieldwork. Reporter Jerry Haddon has more from the beach in Barcelona.
At dawn, here on the Barceloneta beach, the sky is black with thunderclouds. Hardly beach weather, but a couple of vacationing students, Carlota Mateo and Mireia Gonzalez, are renting paddle boards anyway. There's an electrical storm coming, warns a surf shop employee. You can go, he says, but be careful and don't go out too far. Yikes, says Carlota. Well then, we'll be quick about it. A moment later, the students are at the shoreline, ready to shove off, nearly. Carlota unfurls something that looks like a mesh windsock with a wooden yoke at the wide, open end.
Look like a fetish.
desmontarlo un poco.
You just have to unroll it, she says, and clip it to your board with this carabiner, and you drag it floating behind the paddleboard. As Carlota paddles along, the contraption will filter seawater, catching something you might not notice, tiny filaments and beads of microplastic. This is where sport and science meet. The program is actually called Surfing for Science.
Y me interesa mucho poder participar en él. Y el tema de los microplásticos.
This really interests me, Carlota says, because it's a way to help with a huge problem close to where I live. And with that, she turns on her telephone GPS app and paddles off, the plastic trawl in tow. It looks sort of like she's being followed by a small white shark with wooden jaws. A curious sight for the few folks on the sand this early. Carlos Silva, a.k.a. Arcano, a rapper from Venezuela, is downing his last beer after an all-nighter with friends. They've been watching Carlota and Mireia and wondering. Microplastics are interesting, Silva says. You know, last I heard, there are microplastics in our drinking water. It's true, says his friend Samuel Incesi, a sushi chef originally from Senegal. Plastic is everywhere, especially in Africa, he says. It's going to affect all of our lives. Just then, Carlota returns to the beach just to make sure the trawl is working. This is what's great about citizen science, she says. It draws in the general public, even if they don't understand the technical aspects of the science. But it turns out those two partiers are spot on.
Ya vemos que hay bastante recogida.
Lifting the little catch pouch, Carlota says we've already collected a bunch of microplastics. They appear to be from plastic bottles, but they need to be analyzed. That analysis happens just up the hill in a lab at the University of Barcelona. Volunteers drop off their samples, and oceanographer Ana Sanchez slides them under a microscope and counts them, one by one.
But what we found is that there's a lot of plastic in the near shore. Here in the Western Mediterranean, we found more plastic near big cities such as Barcelona. And we found also a big role of the outbreakers and the ports as plastic trapping areas.
The piers and the jetties?
Yes.
That's where they are. But Sanchez is also studying where they come from. There are the usual suspects. A red speck is most likely from the top of a Coca-Cola bottle. Transparent white strands from one-use shopping bags. Then there are some surprises.
Yes, that was like, what are these polyethylene green filaments? A lot of green filaments. And then we realized that's artificial turf.
Turf. Turf. And from where?
Soccer fields, private gardens. Everybody uses artificial turf for decoration, for playing sports. And at the end, this is plastic.
We open in Sneedville. A city, they say, that was plastic and fake, and they liked it that way.
That's right. The plastic world Dr. Seuss's The Lorax was ranting against were there. Sanchez says even if all plastic manufacturing were halted tomorrow, levels in the oceans would rise for decades as waste washes to the sea.
The most important thing, I think, people realize the scale. For example, there's a sample, an horrible sample, taken from October last year, where we found 45 pieces of plastic in each square meter. That's a lot. That's a huge amount of plastic.
And a huge amount of work classifying it all. Without the volunteer help, she says, she'd be light years behind in identifying microplastics, the first step needed for actually getting rid of them. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Now to the world of music. So what's the recipe for a chart-topping hit? In Norway, there's a track that's hugely popular right now that was recorded in Norwegian and Arabic. The song is rooted in social commentary about identity and immigration. The World's Joshua Koh tells us more.
What lasts forever? Money and plastic plants. That's the opening line of the tune PAF.NO. Yes, that's a website too, I'll explain more later. But it's from the Norwegian rap duo Karpe.
We had no idea that this song was going to go number one.
That's Megdi Omar Itraida Abdelmagid. He's one half of Karpe. Chirag Patel is the other half. On their new album, they use multiple languages, Norwegian, English, Gujarati, and Arabic.
That's why we thought it's not going to go number one. It's not going to be like a big thing. And then it turned out we were wrong. So
one of Norway's biggest hits this year has lyrics in Arabic. They're taken from the chorus of a popular Tunisian folk song called Sidi Mansour.
For us, this Tunisian folk song was a song we've heard in so many happy immigrant moments, like Arabic weddings. And we've heard this song since we were kids.
Abdelmagid says they were looking to blend a Tunisian wedding vibe with a Norwegian club vibe. And it works, according to Oslo-based musicologist Kjell Andreas Odekalv.
That's the sound of this year for Norwegian.
Even if you don't understand the cultural significance of the tune, he says, it's a total banger.
It's not your kind of high art conscious rappy 16 bars verses, right? Either it's kind of, it's hooks and hooks and hooks, and it's really, really good hooks, and it's a well-produced track. And if you listen to it like once or twice, you go on humming it for days as well.
It's also got people talking about Norwegian identity, something that this rap duo has been thinking about throughout their 20-year career. 38-year-old Patel, who was born in Norway, says the country has changed a lot.
Norway was a very different country 20 years ago compared to now. It was like we had nobody that looked like us on TV or like in the parliament or anything. We had none of that.
His family origins go back to India. And as for Abdelmagid, his father is Egyptian and his mother is Norwegian. Their backgrounds growing up in the 1990s in Norway inspired their music.
The stuff we rap about are topics that are related to us being the only ones that had a different religion or color in the classroom. But it was very different doing it now than when we did it like 10 years ago. 10 years ago was too early.
A decade ago, Norway experienced something horrific. It was seen by some as a turning point connected to the national conversation about immigration and what it means to be Norwegian. In July 2011, a far-right extremist set off a bomb in front of government buildings in Oslo, and then went on a shooting spree at a summer camp. In total, 77 people died. The killer's manifesto, published hours before the attack, demanded that Muslims in Europe, quote, assimilate 100% or be deported. 1 week after those attacks, the rap duo Karpa performed at a memorial concert for the victims. The event was hosted at one of Oslo's main cathedrals. One song they performed was about tolerance and the experience of Muslims in Norway. I spoke with Marta Bevand Erdal. She's with the Peace Research Institute Oslo. She told me that in the aftermath of those attacks, Norwegians opened up about immigration, national identity, and the idea of belonging.
There's been an increase in awareness that we need to tackle these types of issues properly, and we need to have open discussions and dialogue and listen to each other's experiences, worries, and concerns.
Karpa has played an important role in those discussions. Again, here's musicologist Kjell Andreas Odekalv.
They just had so much full-on mainstream cultural impact. Their songs have become important in the political debates of the mainstream.
The members of Karpa say they want to use that influence to bring about some change, too. About that name of the hit single, if you type PAF.NO into your search engine, you'll find the website for the Patel and Abdelmagid Foundation. It's a fund that they set up to help refugees and immigrants.
We have the opportunity to inspire not to do music for money, but to make a difference.
For the world, I'm Joshua Coe.
Josh's story is part of our Global Songs of Summer project, and we've got a playlist for you of artists you've heard in the series, plus favorite tracks from the world staff. A mellow global soundtrack to your summer. Find a link to the playlist on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. We'll be right back. some sobering words from the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres yesterday in New York. Speaking at the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference, Guterres said the tensions that lifted after the end of the Cold War are back again.
We have been extraordinarily lucky so far, but luck is not a strategy, nor is it a shield from geopolitical tensions boiling over into nuclear conflict. Today, humanity is just one misunderstanding, one miscalculation away from nuclear annihilation. We need the treaty of non-proliferation of nuclear weapons as much as ever.
My next guest knows a lot about non-proliferation treaties. Daryl Kimball is the executive director of the Arms Control Association in Washington. Daryl, you're attending the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference in New York. What's your take on Guterres' assessment?
I think this meeting is a critical opportunity to press the nuclear arms states to fulfill their obligations. But the danger is still with us. And of course, Vladimir Putin's nuclear threats earlier this year reminded us of that. The United States and Russia are not talking about nuclear arms control since the war began.
Remind us where the world is at with non-proliferation treaties. What's still in effect?
Well, the non-proliferation treaty itself was entered into force in 1970. We still have that. But most of the major bilateral agreements between the United States and Russia that helped keep the peace during the Cold War are gone or they're in jeopardy. There's only one treaty today, the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty from 2010, that's still in effect, that still caps the world's two largest nuclear arsenals, the United States and Russia. The discussions on further nuclear reductions have faltered. There was a compliance dispute about Russian testing of a system that was not allowed by the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. They had a compliance dispute over the Open Skies Treaty, which was a transparency agreement developed in 1990 to allow overflights of each other's territory to provide early warning about military movements. So in the last 3 years, those two treaties were dissolved because the United States withdrew because of alleged Russian noncompliance. So we're down to one major nuclear arms control agreement, New START, and unless the U.S. and Russia resume talks on that agreement, which Putin and Biden both say they are willing to do, but they haven't begun. If we don't have a replacement treaty, there will be no limits on the world's two largest nuclear arsenals for the first time since 1972.
So if Russia and the U.S. don't renegotiate the New START arms treaty, that would allow either Russia or the U.S. to build as many nuclear weapons as they want?
That's correct. Now, will they want to? Is that necessary? I would argue absolutely not, because each country already has more than enough firepower to absolutely devastate the other in the event of the outbreak of nuclear hostilities.
Under the Trump administration, it's been well documented that the State Department was neglected. It lost a ton of staff. Did that have an impact on these treaties?
Well, I think it did. The United States and Russia have not negotiated a major treaty in over a decade. The knowledge that's needed, the technical, the military, the scientific, the diplomatic, to put together one of these agreements is considerable. And negotiating with the Russians at any time is not easy, especially now. And negotiating a new set of agreements to deal with the world's most dangerous weapons takes time. So the Biden administration is trying to repopulate its State Department team, its national security team, with people who can do this. But the two presidents need to direct their teams to get to work to make sure that there's not a gap in the controls on the U.S. and Russian nuclear stockpiles.
When these treaties are in place, what makes them work?
Well, we don't just negotiate an agreement with another country and hope that they're going to abide by the agreement. What makes arms control, nuclear arms control agreements particularly effective is when there are verification and monitoring provisions that help us understand whether our counterpart is doing what they are supposed to do. So the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, for instance, allows the United States and Russia to inspect each other's nuclear facilities to verify that the national declarations of each side are accurate and complete. and that there's no significant cheating that's going on.
In the beginning of this conversation, you mentioned the importance of both sides simply talking. Why?
Well, both sides, as difficult as it is to sit down and talk with our Russian counterparts right now, both sides need to understand the meaning behind public statements, the nature of each side's concerns and worries, and they need to exchange practical proposals about mitigating these kinds of threats and concerns. And you only do that by engaging in direct diplomacy. And there's a great deal of hemming and hawing about doing this right now because of the war. The Russians are hesitant to meet with the Americans and to talk about certain issues and vice versa. But I don't think either side really has a choice right now. It's a responsibility to sit down and talk about one of, if not the most consequential issues between these two countries. Relations are bad, but relations were bad during the Cold War. Let me just remind us that the first bilateral agreement limiting U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals was struck in 1972. The United States was involved in the war in Vietnam. The Soviet Union was supporting the United States' enemy, North Vietnam. And yet the two sides understood that it was in their mutual interest to limit their nuclear arsenals to help avoid an all-out nuclear arms race.
Daryl Kimball is the executive director of the Arms Control Association. He's attending the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Conference in New York. Thanks a lot, Daryl.
Thank you.
Let's check in again on those travel woes at European airports. Call it news you can use for people who are traveling soon, or schadenfreude for folks who aren't going anywhere. London's Heathrow Airport has been the epicenter of logistical chaos in European air travel this summer. Today, Heathrow announced it's not allowing new bookings on outbound short-haul flights for the next week. British Airways says the move will help them handle the backload of passengers trying to fly out of Heathrow. It's a temporary strategy to help an overstretched airport hit by staffing shortages and a surge in travelers and mountains of lost luggage. It's not just Heathrow that's taking action. Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport is also trying to get on top of the travel chaos. It's capping daily passenger numbers at several thousand below normal through October. And this is where we come in for a landing. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills.